how fickle happiness is. It's fickle, isn't it? Because on the drive here today from the hills, I was, you know, windows down, sun shining, singing, I'm on the top. No, I wasn't singing that. But and I thought, I'll go Roe Highway. It's quicker. 2 kilometre tailback. You know, you're just happiness, gone. Why do you mock me? You know, I had that feeling. And I was just stuck in traffic. I'm not going to get there. And it's just like tense. Happiness is that fickle, I reckon. And for something that holds a lot of store, you heard those questions, it's pretty fickle. It's got to carry a lot of weight because it's carrying a lot of weight at the moment. It's creaking, I would say. Now, you might have seen on Facebook, there's a 100 Happy Days campaign. Anyone signed up for 100 Happy Days? No? Anyone? Well, let me read. 100happydays.com was started, and it's gone fairly viral, obviously, among the more mature members of the establishment. But it poses this question. It says, we live in times when super busy schedules have become something to boast about. While the speed of life increases, there is less and less time to enjoy the moment that you are in, the ability to appreciate the moment, the environment, and yourself in it. That's the base for the bridge towards long-term happiness of any human being. And then there's a big 71% on the front page of 100happydays.com. 71% of people tried to complete this challenge but failed, quoting lack of time as the main reason. Not misery, I suppose. These people simply do not have time to be happy, do you? And, well, I thought, well, it depends on the 100 days. You know, I could think of 100 days in my life that I could, you know, it'd be like Groundhog Day, living a great day, which would be great. But imagine living, you know, the day your cat died every day. Or, you know, that wouldn't be so happy. And it's a bit like dieting, I would have thought, that, you know, I can diet for 100 days or whatever period of time. I'm going to diet. And then, you know, one day you go, what the heck? I'm going to eat cake. And you eat the whole thing. And then you don't go, well, that's just one day out of 100. You start again, don't you? Well, we'll start again, 100 days from today. But what happens when something big does happen in your 100 happy days? See, if the cat dies, well, you start again in a week. But if your mum dies or your partner leaves you, well, maybe we'll get back to happy in a couple of years' time. That's how fickle happiness is. But don't worry, it's still up for sale because my wife walked past this down in, I think, one of the galleries, I think, Next Happiness Workshop, 7th of August, Thursday, 10 a.m, limited slots available. Think, wow, what if I can't wait till the 7th of August? What if all the slots are used up? You know, are limited slots available? What if I'm suicidally unhappy on August the 6th? I can't wait. What do? What if it's full? And I think happiness is a good one to have as our last talk. We've looked at belonging, sex and purpose in the context of being fulfilled and our cravings being satisfied. But happiness really does, that's the mother of all cravings, isn't it? I think it's the one that people attach most to because it hits the sweet spot. Hit the sweet spot of happiness and bingo. And the classic line in our culture at the moment is, and this underscores a lot of what we do and why we do it, don't I have the right to be happy? Don't I have the right to be happy? See, the modern pursuit of happiness has had a moral high ground, I would say, with the USA's Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now that's the peak of Enlightenment thinking, and it's a brilliant summary of human flourishing, I think. It was well put together because it covers everything without being too specific. If you're going to write a Declaration of Independence, like for yourself, just be general. You don't need too much specific because it can cover everything, basically. But in one sense, when they wrote those words, the founding fathers of America, they didn't realise it, but maybe they just took it for granted, that happiness was tethered at some level. The pursuit of happiness was tethered to all the things behind it in the Declaration. There were common views about truth. We hold these truths to be self-evident. There was a common view about the spiritual life, that all men, and though it probably was men, are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. There's a universal idea about God and a universal idea about rights. And it's also interesting that they use the word among. That among these unalienable rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The founding fathers created that statement in a context that had strong mutual obligation, a strong religious framework, and a thick level of civil communal understanding, I would say. A way of understanding how the world's put together that seemed to just naturally spring that forth. Hence, none of those terms or concepts were held up as more important than one of the others. They were a foundation to build upon. They're treated like a game of Jenga, almost. You put them together and you start to take them out. You be careful, because the whole thing will fall down. Or kerplunk. Anyone from my day remember kerplunk? Yeah? No? Yeah? Oh, even your day. Where you put marbles in with the little sticks and you pull the sticks out and you try to get the marbles not to fall. The issue in our culture is that happiness has become untethered from those things. And we've been removing the blocks from the Jenga tower at a rapid pace. The concept of truth and its self-evidence no longer applies. The creation of humanity is no longer assumed, neither is the creator. Unalienable rights, fast disappearing or changing. And we are left with maybe clinging to those last four words, the pursuit of happiness. Among these has, in some senses, been reduced, or at least overshadowed by, only this, only this. And the speed at which everything is falling down is surprising us, but it shouldn't be altogether unexpected, and neither are the results. Yale professor of theology, Miroslav Volf, who's been on Q&A this year, said this: the idea of flourishing as a human being, and that's what happiness would have meant, flourishing as a human being. It was a totality of life, not just a single pursuit. The idea of flourishing as a human being has shriveled to meaning no more than leading an experientially satisfying life. The sources of satisfaction may vary: power, possessions, love, religion, sex, food, drugs, whatever. What matters the most is not the source of satisfaction, but the experience of it. My satisfaction. And he says this to sum it up: our satisfied self is our best hope. That's his indictment of the culture. Our satisfied self is our best hope. I think that is a brilliant summary of where we've come from in the Western context, from the US Declaration of Independence through to now. Our satisfied self is our best hope. And in Australia, we have no such declaration, but I've seen its modern equal. I was in Target seeing what the poor people wear, and there on the back wall was a better vision of modern reality, because the Target vision statement was on the back wall of Target in Midland. I was actually buying jocks, because everyone buys jocks in Target, don't they? But John Howard was looking for a preamble to the Constitution when he was Prime Minister, and he could have done worse than the Target vision statement. Because it's not saying nakedly be happy, but it says this. This is written on the wall: every Australian has the right to look good and feel good about the way they dress and live. Every Australian has the right to look good and feel good about the way they dress and live. Buy this stuff and you'll be happy. Though it's not nakedly saying that, is it? It's sort of opening you up to a bit more of a cultural sophistication. Yes, I do have the right to look good and feel good about the way I dress and live. And it may not be Target, it might be Apple or whatever. It may not be anything to do with stuff, it may be to do with experience. But every Australian has the right to look good and feel good about the way they dress and live. There's a totality to the statement that happiness is the goal. Rights, looks, feelings, appearance, and goals in my life that I wish to pursue. And it's interesting that one of their ad campaigns was 100% happy. Man, that's a hard call, isn't it? How do you feel? Are you 100% happy? Well, 73% possibly, you know, maybe 74 on a good day. And that vision statement is a funnel down which you can pour your own meaning, your idea of happiness. Line up your goals and you'll be happy. And if you haven't lined them up, what or who is stopping you? Here's the problem, though. When you line them all up and you're still not happy, what happens then? Which, of course, is where Australia probably is. If every Australian has the right to look good and feel good about the way they dress and live, and we live in a place where we've never had so much, why do we have a mental health crisis as we do? Anxiety, depression, boredom. There are huge mental health issues in Australia at the moment. The conditions would appear to be perfect for happiness, but the Jenga tower is collapsing. I see three fatal flaws to modern happiness. Modern happiness has become a goal, not a byproduct. We pursue the right product. The byproduct should take care of itself. But if you pursue the byproduct, you might just go out of business. That would be business law, wouldn't it? If it's about the love of money when you start business, your business may fail. But if you love the product so much that other people catch the infectious nature of that and see its use, you might end up getting the byproduct. But modern happiness also, secondly, is genetically a thoroughbred, not a mongrel. We need more mongrels of happiness. I need to be able to drive and row highway and not just suddenly switch into grumpiness, frustration, when the traffic snarls 45 minutes away from UWA. There's something fickle about happiness that changes when the wind changes, that dies at a small coal. It's a thoroughbred, not geared for modern life. It needs more mongrel to it to be able to survive. And the other thing is that modern happiness is viewed as a solo race, not a team sport. My happiness, my satisfied life. It's not talking about communal happiness in general, which is okay, but my happiness in particular. Sacrifices may need to be made by others if I'm to be happy. I mentioned my twin brother on Facebook the other day. Is this as good as it gets? Well, you've sacrificed a few things to get there and a few people. Probably that's as good as it gets by the time you get to your third marriage. And look behind you. Look at all the human remains. The Bible has much to say about happiness. So it's an important topic. And it uses lots of words to describe happiness, or in that semantic field of language. Joy, pleasure, rejoicing, be glad. In fact, God often commands joy and happiness in the Bible. But central to the biblical message is not happiness untethered, but happiness tethered. And in particular, tethered to God. Psalm 16, one of the songs of Israel's hymnal, says this: in your presence there is fullness of joy, at your right hand are pleasures forevermore. Talking about God. 100% happy, fullness of joy, 100% of the time, forevermore. That's what the Bible holds out. And that's what the people in the story in Exodus, in your Bible reading, if you have a look at it, were risking. Have a look at that Bible reading. I'm going to read it to you. And I'll explain it to you, because it seems a little bit of an arcane passage to choose. Then the Lord said to Moses, leave this place, you and the people you brought up out of Egypt, and go up to the land I promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, saying, I will give it to your descendants. I will send an angel before you and drive out the Canaanites, Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites and Jebusites. Go up to the land flowing with milk and honey. But I will not go with you, because you are a stiff-necked people, and I might destroy you on the way. When the people heard these distressing words, they began to mourn, and no one put on any ornaments. For the Lord had said to Moses, tell the Israelites, you are a stiff-necked people. If I were to go with you even for a moment, I might destroy you. Now take off your ornaments, and I will decide what to do with you. So the Israelites stripped off their ornaments at Mount Horeb. This passage exposes the truth of the reality that happiness revolves around God. God presents the nation of Israel with 100% happy without him. And given what's just happened, you might almost take that you might almost take that offer. Now, it seems like an interesting passage to choose about happiness, but let me explain the context. Israel has just come out of slavery to Egypt, and they've come into the desert where God is going to meet them at Mount Sinai and give him his laws for how they live as his people, now that they are his people. And so Moses goes up to the top of this mountain to get the Ten Commandments, and down below they decide, oh, well, we might as well get into idol worship. And they make a golden calf, and they worship it, while Moses is getting, ironically, the commandments which say that they should only worship God. Now, he comes down the mountain, it all goes crazy. Lots of people die, and then the dust settles. And then God says, the land that you're going into is a great land, but I'm not going with you. I just burn you up, man. Tell you what, I'll send an angel with you. And that angel is going to take you into the promised land. Because I'm not going with you because of the way you behave. It's still going to be a land flowing with milk and honey. The angel's going to go before you and wipe out, you know, help you wipe out all your enemies. I'm going to offer you happiness untethered. Happiness not tethered to me. You know, I'd be going, sounds a good offer. You know, given that I've just seen thousands of people from my tribe slaughtered by God for disobedience, I think we'll take the angel. Okay, I think we'll go to the land of milk and honey and enjoy ourselves. Because what does it mean by the land of milk and honey? Okay, it's probably just Perth's weather, Sydney's nightlife, Melbourne's coffee, all rolled into one without Adelaide. That sounds good, doesn't it? That sounds amazing. It's target vision statement for them. And what do they do? Yay, let's go. No, they mourn. It says, when the people heard these disastrous words, and Moses says to God, if you're not going, we're not going. If you're not going, we're not going. God offers them all the good things without God, and they mourn. Can you see how this passage is very similar to us today? Why do they mourn? Because they recognize, even in spite of their fickle craving, that happiness is a great byproduct, but a poor goal if they don't have God. They could have the stuff that God created without the Creator, and that would be awful. They mourn. The trouble is, as their story unfolds, they don't mourn enough. They keep going back to find happiness without God. And their tragic story is a prototype of humans' tragic story. By the time they get to be living in their own land, having dispossessed all the nations, and they've got kings, they've got everything they should have, one of their spokesmen for God, Jeremiah, an Old Testament prophet, says this. God comes to him and says to Jeremiah, say to the people, my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewed out cisterns or wells for themselves, broken cisterns that can hold no water. It's a double tragedy. They're sucking on sand in the desert, almost, in a vain attempt to quench their thirst and be happy, when there's no need to. There's a deep well of living water. That might ring a bell from what Jesus said to that woman at the well. There's a deep well of living water not 10 yards away. It would be tragic to die of thirst next to a well, wouldn't it? There was a fire in Tenterton about 12, 15 years ago. And my mum's friend and the friend's daughter died of asphyxiation and burns on the edge of the dam on their property because they couldn't get to it in time. A terrible thing to die with life right next to you, isn't it? And that becomes the operating system of ancient Israel. They never stop to think for a moment, if the gifts are this desirous, how much more the giver of the gifts? And what Jeremiah calls two evils for Israel is shown in the New Testament as not just Israel's problem, humans' problem. Listen to the words of Romans chapter 1. For the wrath of God, or God's anger, is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men and women who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honour him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. If I were to sum those verses up, 18 to 20 says, we hold these truths to be self-evident. That's what God is saying. This is true about God. This is true about how he's put the world together. So we should be happy and thankful in him. But verses 21 to 23 say we don't. We do not thank the Creator, but we worship created stuff. Whatever you think the ickiest sin or bad thing is in the world, it can be summed up in that. A refusal to acknowledge God and thank and worship him, and instead worship the things that he has made. Now at this point you might be thinking, well, I'm not a worshipper because I'm an atheist. I don't worship created stuff or idols. Well, let's just take the word worship to mean giving ultimate allegiance to. And the best sermon I've ever heard, bar none, from an atheist at least, was by the late lamented David Foster Wallace. You may have heard of his commencement address at the liberal arts college in the US, Kenyon College. And he stood up in front of all the bright young things who are looking for happiness now that they're getting into uni and graduating and all those things. And he says this: in the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is actually no such thing as atheism. There is no such thing as not worshipping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And an outstanding reason for choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough. Never feel you have enough. It's the truth. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. Whew. Every day Friday. Yeah. Happiness, untethered, can work for a while. But its problems are that it can turn around and bite you. The things you thought made you happy may not. Or it can elude you just beyond your reach. Worse still, you may find it in something and be completely happy and satisfied and miss out on happiness tethered to God. The worst thing is not to be dissatisfied or unsatisfied in the created stuff. The worst thing is to be completely satisfied in it. Such happiness, untethered, sets the bar too low. And more importantly, God hates it. So C.S. Lewis blended these problems perfectly, as he often did. He says, we are half-hearted creatures, fooling about with drink and sex and ambition, when infinite joy is offered us, like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by an offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased. See, that's the scary thought, isn't it? Not that we're too hard to please and we just got to keep upgrading to the next iPhone, but that we're too easily pleased. That is all it takes. But that's all it takes. How about you? How easily pleased are you? It's a question that Jesus posed to the nation of Israel in his day, which was still searching for that elusive happiness. but through something a little bit more sophisticated than a golden calf. They wanted meaning, significance and happiness in the way they wanted to shape God and to do what they wanted, rather than God to be the God he is. They were still shaping God, he just wasn't made out of gold in their idolatry. But through their performance, their racial superiority and moral superiority, they thought they ticked all the boxes. And Jesus comes and challenges Israel once again. Will you aim for the source of happiness or simply settle for the experience? And hear the wise words of Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew. You've got those verses in front of you. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again, and then in his joy went and sold all he had and bought that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls, who on finding one pearl of great value, went and sold all that he had and bought it. Now the first saying, the first parable there, verse 44, is a saying of contrast almost. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field which a man found and covered up. Then in his joy he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. The key term is in his joy. In his joy he does that. Everything else doesn't look worth it compared to that. What makes him give up everything for the kingdom of heaven? Not his duty, not his curbing of his joys, but cashing everything in, selling it all up, single-minded pursuit of what is the source of his joy. And the second saying is a saying of comparison. The kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls, who in finding one pearl of great value, went and sold all that he had and bought it. The key term here is of great value. Nothing else stacks up. And all the business students here are screaming out, spread your risk, man, you know, speak to your advisor. And what does Jesus say? Reckless abandon, caution to the wind, put it all on number 7, race 3 at Ascot on Saturday. Whew, that's a big risk. Jesus offers us in the kingdom what God always offered his people, and which so tragically they spurned, Psalm 16. Fullness of joy, pleasure forevermore. Tethered to the joy giver and the creator of pleasure, God. Desires not curbed, but redirected and fulfilled. Would you settle for 100 happy days? Fullness of joy. Pleasure forevermore. See, if you like your satisfaction cheap and cheerful, and your happiness at the touch of an on switch, or your joy in small, shriveled chunks, take your hands away, walk backwards to safety, you're already there. But if you're sitting in the gutter, making mud pies from the street crud, picking out the cigarette butts and the used needles, there's a trip to the seaside on offer, and the bus is leaving in 10 minutes. Thank you.
So now we're going to have a bit of time for questions. So if you've got any questions you'd like to ask Steve, you can ask them now.
And anything about the last couple of days as well? So, if there are any questions you didn't ask, if you wanted to from earlier in the week. I think if you're going to say happiness tethered when you're talking about joy, it's got to be beyond circumstance, doesn't it? So, Christian joy isn't happiness, though sometimes you see it expressed that way, but. Joy beyond, happiness beyond circumstance is probably what I'm looking at. But also that Christian joy isn't it's not about stoicism as such, is it? Because Jesus holds out there's great reward. The joy we have now is sort of is pulling us towards the full joy of reward at the end of the age, I believe. When God cleans it all up, makes the universe and the world as it was meant to be. So it's not circumstantial. I think that's probably what I'd say. Happiness that is not tethered to circumstance is untouchable. You can't crush it, you can't stop it. It's what, you know, can it all joy when you suffer. Hang on, how do you do that? Because it's not tethered to my experience of suffering in life. It's tethered somewhere else. And Jesus was, you know, for the joy set before him, endured the cross. So Jesus is our joyful example. And you wouldn't go around saying that he had the best set of circumstances on the planet. But he was joyous at the same time because it was untouchable joy in that sense. So, you know, happiness comes in all sorts of shapes and sizes. But as I said yesterday, our purpose, it's can the thing last, A, in this life, and can it last into the age to come? That's a crucial aspect. Other questions?
Do you think,
like,
on that,
yeah.
Do you think Jesus was joyous as he was dying on the cross?
No, I think it's man of sorrows as well. Yeah. I think you can be sorrowful yet joyful at the same time. In the sense of Paul says, we don't grieve when someone dies as those who have no hope. I have done a lot of funerals. Let me tell you my experience of a funeral for a Christian and a funeral for someone who's not a Christian who has no faith in the Lord, right? I would expect to go to a non-Christian funeral, conducted, and I would expect that the funeral would be like the life of someone who doesn't regard God. That it would be not flowery, not sentimental, not spiritually minded, not talking about an afterlife. But that's the opposite of what I hear. It's all, you know, they're going to be a flower in God's garden. Really? That's interesting, because you didn't live like that idea was important. You went to a Christian funeral, I found a deep realism about death, that there's sorrow that's based in reality. That person died, but joy beyond it. It doesn't suck away all your hope. The only problem is, like, as you walk through the cemetery, I pay attention to what's being said in that funeral cortege. Right? And if you're up the front, you're in full grief. But just, I slowed my pace down deliberately. And by the time you get to the back, where all the I knew him once and I better come to his funeral people are, they're talking about the football and white goods. And my goodness. Everyone's eventually going to get to the front and then boot the person at the front in the coffin, right? But it never triggers that there's something beyond this life that they should be aiming for, that can't touch their joy. I found that unnerving almost at a funeral. That I think Jesus was a man of sorrows and joy at the same time. On the cross, he bore the full weight of sin, which would not be joyous. But the only way to joy was through. What he meant for us.
Yeah? How do you think any of this applies to the
how does it apply to people who believe in a non-Christian God? I think happiness is something that comes with living in a good creation. I don't think that's, it's just Christians are happy because plainly they're not. You know? And plenty of Christians suffer depression and things like that as well. The key question to me is always the resurrection. The resurrection is what gives meaning, I think. I think the resurrection of Jesus is so unique in the history of the world and the history of how religion is put together that I think that happiness can continue through lots of things and through lots of good structures in life and stable family environments. But it's the fact that it ends that I think is different between Christianity. A resurrected body is our God as a Christian. God likes stuff and he likes good stuff because he created it. I think I've never seen a thick enough view of what the afterlife looks like that matches Christianity at all, especially because of the resurrection. And the resurrection changed everyone who was miserable because Jesus had died, didn't it? They saw it and they were astonished. It changed them from sad to happy pretty quickly. A joy that couldn't be taken away. So I think Jesus is the focal point for me between other religions, is that it doesn't focus on the theological framework or philosophical framework, but
person Jesus, the fact that he broke through death, that would be the key. I would start there. I think there's other avenues, but I would always start with that aspect because it's the pointiest aspect of it. Death destroys all happiness. If death is destroyed, what does that mean for happiness? That doesn't give you all the answers. Start with Jesus. Time's up, I think, guys. Thanks. Oh, there's one more. Can we have one more question?
Yeah, is it possible to find joy in a non-Abrahamic God? And also, leading on from that, like, hold on to that joy up until death and looking past death and expecting that kind of joy as well?
Yeah, look, obviously, because people do. The question is, can that be backed up? We really believe that the resurrection of Jesus is a historical event backed up by observation, history, etc. So clearly you can find joy in any form of religious expression and idolatry in the Bible because they found a certain level of happiness in it. That's what I would say. So, but I only think that once again, back to Jesus, the issue of joy beyond it, there has to be something about it that's to do with who we are as human beings and how disconnecting death is of us from who we're meant to be. If a religion has a way of figuring out death that takes it seriously, it's probably, I think you can have more conversation with it. But if it's as if you just go to another room or something, I say, hang on, that's not really taking death seriously. Death is a crucial aspect for me, how it deals with death and how it deals with resurrection. But then again, I also believe that the joy we have comes from God by the power of His Holy Spirit within us as Christians. That's crucial as well. I'd like to answer it longer, but I'm being invaded by 100 engineers.